Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
I want to talk about a really uplifting topic: death, suffering, evil. Our culture is interesting and unhealthy in some ways. I think with respect to big important questions, not just about death and suffering and evil, but about virtue and vice, about marriage, about love, about happiness, we have a really constricted vocabulary. And our political discourse is not helping, because our political discourse is really shallow, and we seem to have politicized everything, which means that we're in effect, to some extent, losing the resources from outside of politics that we might bring into politics to perhaps elevate it a bit. But it is important that we think about, and I think the Thomistic Institute gives us an opportunity to reflect upon some of these things. It's interesting that with respect to death, Americans increasingly don't know what to do or say as someone is approaching death and after someone dies. Significant decline in funeral services across the country. Some of this is COVID. Some of it is the rise in costs of funerals. But a lot of it, if you read, and I actually wrote a piece for the Dallas Morning News about this, if you read up on the decline in funerals, a good bit of it has to do with people, that is, children, spouses, relatives, friends of the deceased, really not knowing what to do at a funeral. There will be people there I've never met, partly because sometimes the deceased person has been separated from family and friends physically, geographically. I don't know what to say. We lack a vocabulary. One of the reasons that, there are many reasons, but one of the reasons that immigrants are a great blessing to this country right now is that immigrants bring with them rich rituals for death. They know how to, I wrote an article on the one I mentioned for the Dallas Morning News on St. Patrick's Day about growing up in the suburbs of DC. So I'm not Irish myself, surrounded by Irish. And an old Irish wake is truly something to experience. And there's a lot of storytelling, which is a mixture of truth telling and fibbing. There's a wide array of emotions that move quite naturally from joy and laughter to sorrow and tears and back. We've lost the ability to know how to express rich, authentic emotion and grief in the face of death that's also hopeful. I think also that you put on the one side our silence in the face of death. Juxtapose that to the kind of experiences we can have in popular culture of violence and death, which can be extremely graphic and explicit. And you can think about video games, you can think about the horror genre and some really violent subgenres within horror that are quite popular. You can even think in a milder version about our investigative TV shows like CSI, which have very graphic depictions of death. Some of those actually have a language for thinking about and responding to death. People who have to face it every day typically have a language. But we know from doctors that they have an increasingly hard time these days going to families, going to someone who is about to die and saying, we've exhausted all of the medical possibilities. That's always been difficult, and we've always wanted to fight and keep people alive whom we love, perfectly natural. But our focus on technology and medicine leads us to want always to defer the thought of death. Again, something healthy. I want to actually read a couple passages, but I want to begin with a clip from this film. All the film clips that I'm showing are from sort of the early 2000s. I want to show this clip from this film, Gravity, which is actually later. This is 2013. This is a film with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney as sort of astronauts. And they get hit. They get out of their space station and get hit with a barrage of space stones and get separated. And George Clooney is just gone. He sort of disappears very quickly. Sandra Bullock is alone floating in this little capsule in space, thinking that she's lost for good. I will leave to you the finale of that plot and not give anything significant away. But at this point, she's got a radio that seems to have contacted someone. The accent sounds like China. And so she's going back and forth, but there's no real communication. But this, in a mainstream film, I think what she does here is actually quite remarkable. Oops, I'm in the wrong thing. Let me play this. She hears howling on the radio contact, and that's why she's responding in that way.
Nobody will mourn for me. No one will pray for my soul. Will you mourn for me? Will you say a prayer for me? Or is it too late? I mean, I'd say one for myself, but I've never prayed in my life. So nobody ever taught me at all.
I love this clip. It's actually remarkable to find this in a mainstream Hollywood movie. Alfonso Cuarón, a really talented director. This is one of these cases where, and one of the last clips I want to show will be similar in this way, where you have lots of scenes of death in film and in TV. It's pretty rare. This is an unusual scene where someone is completely isolated in outer space, right? But it's pretty rare in those scenes for anyone to start thinking about actually preparing for death, right? That's the first thing I love about this. The second thing I love about it is the opening, everybody's going to die, but I'm going to die today. The particularization, right? The moving from the abstract, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. You can do the syllogism and you could substitute yourself in there, but there's something about concretizing it with respect to this moment and your mortality, right? So it's unusual in a way because she's got time to think about this, but lots of people in film and television actually have time, but they're not often depicted as doing much other than trying to find new cures or reach out to people that they've lost contact with, all of which is fine. But this, I think, puts the question very directly. Right? I'm going to die alone. No one will mourn for me. No one will pray for me. I could pray, but no one taught me. The explicit statement of, I've lost a language for knowing the point I was just making, about losing the ritual, losing the language, losing the practices that might help you to know what to do and say as you approach death. It's a really brilliant, it's a well-done movie. It's not a great movie, but it's a good movie. It also raises this question about how we ought to think about that. And I want to read two very brief passages, one from two 17th century, 16th and then 17th century French philosophers, Montaigne and then Pascal. Montaigne has wrote this book called Essays. It's just extended essays on various topics. And one of these is entitled, To Philosophize is to Learn How to Die. This is how I pitch a philosophy major at Baylor. Come give us your money and we'll teach you how to die. Actually, if we could teach that, we should get a lot of money. Because it's not easy to teach. So Montaigne is here talking about this quote from Solon, this ancient thinker, call no one happy until they're dead. Again, not a very uplifting thought, right? And Montaigne says, it seems likely that he was intending to tell us that happiness in life, depending as it does on the tranquility and contentment of a spirit well-born and on the resolution and assurance of an ordered soul, may never be attributed to any man until we have seen him act out the last scene in his play, which is indubitably the hardest. In all the rest, he can wear an actor's mask. At this moment, the actor's mask is pulled off and you appear as you authentically are. Montaigne says, if this is true, how should we think about death? To begin depriving death of its greatest advantage over us, the paralyzing fear of thinking about death, let us adopt a way contrary to the common one. Let us deprive death of its strangeness. Let us frequent it. Let us get used to it. Let us have nothing more often in mind than death. At every instant, let us evoke it in our imagination under all its aspects. We do not know where death awaits us, so let us wait for it everywhere. To practice death is to practice freedom. Knowing how to die gives us freedom from subjection and constraint. Not sure that you want someone as your freshman roommate who's always walking around talking about how they think about death. But Montaigne is in effect saying that through this kind of meditation, this is a kind of standard Stoic approach to death. Montaigne is very much writing as a Stoic. We can turn death into a friend. We can turn it from an enemy into a friend. That enemy or friend is going to stay with us for a while. Pascal, much more brief. Montaigne's Christianity sometimes thought to be suspect. It's in a way not completely relevant here, although Pascal might say it is. He's sort of adopting a purely philosophical approach. What could we do philosophically? Pascal's having none of it. The last act, that was just Montaigne's line. We know that when he wrote his Pensées, he had Montaigne's text right here, and he was riffing off of Montaigne and criticizing him quite a bit. The last act is bloody, however fine the rest of the play. They throw earth over your head, and it's finished forever. Pretty harsh. But he's directly saying we cannot make death fully into a friend. It always remains an enemy. The last act is bloody, no matter what. Okay. Can we make it a friend? Can we not? I think this, Sandra Bullock is facing implicitly this question as well. Is it always and everywhere an evil? And even if it is, can we reduce the evil that we face? I want to mention two things here about this. One is, this goes back to the question of violence. And again, I'll come back. I'm actually going to end by reading a short passage from Harry Potter about death as an enemy. I think we can learn stuff from films like this. I also think, I'm not going to show the clip, The Hunger Games. Do you all know The Hunger Games? So, you know that what's the basic plot, right, is that the tribunes from the various areas have to come and pick a young person to be enclosed in an area and fight to the death where there's one victor. And this is a punishment for a rebellion that's going on in these subjected areas, right? The capital is trying to keep people in place. And by undergoing this ritual, it's indicating we are in control of your lives. The other thing that's going on there is the murder of innocent people by other previously innocent people as a form of entertainment. The opening scene is an interview where they talk about how these rituals of the Hunger Games bind the society together. Suzanne Collins, who wrote the books, said that she got the idea for this when she was flipping around her TV set during the Gulf War and moved from the equivalent of whatever the equivalent was of the Kardashians to footage, carnage in the Gulf War. And she was thinking about our detachment as we move from one scene to another. And it's what I call something like CNN compassion. That's not a reflection on CNN. It's what we do, many of us, when we come across on CNN or other news channels, images of horrible events happening here, maybe down the street, certainly across the globe. We have a momentary feeling of, oh, that's awful, and then we flip the channel. The Hunger Games is asking us to reflect. I mean, it's actually, if you're reading the book or watching the movie, what the opening is asking you to do is to say, why are you here? Why are you watching this? Why are you eager to be entertained by innocent children slaughtering one another? Of course, there's another level in the film, and even in the action for the participants, because we do pretty quickly get a heroine who wants to undo the entire system, right? So we actually have someone to root for. But at the beginning, all we know is we're going to see innocent people slaughtered. Have we become, these films are asking, so detached in our feelings about death that we've turned death, violence, and suffering into entertainment for jaded, advanced American society? Another way to think about violence in films is to think about it as perhaps trying to do what violence, when it was justified, has traditionally tried to do, which is to combat evil and protect the good. I'm going to show a clip from Christopher Nolan's Batman Begins. So after he's been away in training, and he's coming back with his sense of calling now as Batman.
Master Wayne, you've been gone a long time.
Yes, I have.
You look very fashionable. Apart from the bat. Are you coming back from Gotham for looks?
As long as it takes. I'm going to show the people that Gotham, their city, doesn't belong to the crones and the corrupt.
In the Depression, your father nearly bankrupted Wayne Enterprises combating poverty. He believed that his example could inspire the wealthy of Gotham to save their city. In a way, their murder shocked the wealthy into powerful interaction.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol, I can be incorruptible. I can be everlasting.
What's it?
Something elemental, something terrifying.
I assume that as you're taking on the underworld, this symbol is a persona to protect those you care about from reprisals.
You think about Rachel? Actually, sir, I'll save it myself. Have you told anyone I'm coming back?
I just couldn't figure the legal ramifications of bringing you back from the dead.
Dead?
You've been gone 7 years.
You had me declared dead.
Well, actually, it was Mr. Earl. He's taken the company public. He wanted to liquidate your majority shareholder. Those shares were one bit one.
That's a good thing I left everything even.
Quite so, sir. And you can borrow the rolls if you like. Just lean back with a full tank.
Okay. Good opening passage. I think this, Nolan's obviously one of our most interesting and creative contemporary filmmakers. I remember when I saw this, it was one of those films that as soon as I came out of it in the theater, I wanted to go talk with people about it. And that's a sign, I think, that a film has really worked on you in the way great filmmakers like to work on the souls and imaginations of viewers. I think the film is, in particularly the first one, is in a way a thought experiment. This is what Nolan invests the traditional Batman superhero story with, is what's left when you take away divine, natural, and human justice. Batman is in a Gotham where the innocent are weak and despairing, and where the strong are corrupt and evil. I don't know if you remember the two scenes that I love that I think help to indicate the vacancy, the moral vacancy of this universe. Remember the scenes of Batman on the tops of buildings where he looks like a gargoyle in a medieval cathedral? And then the scene where he's on the top of a building and he's got one of these petty kind of drug dealers, and he throws whatever tool he's got down and pulls the guy up in front of him. He's actually hanging upside down. And he asks the guy about the details of this drug deal and so forth. And the guy says, I swear to God, it's true. And Batman pulls him up close and says, don't swear to God, swear to me. Batman in this film is a gargoyle in a godless Gotham. This is a universe where divine standards of justice, natural standards of justice, and human standards of justice have disappeared. What's left? Well, what's left in Bruce Wayne is the natural hunger for justice and the natural desire, however much it's been diluted, the natural hunger for justice and the natural desire to want to fight to protect the innocent. So it's actually an extreme thought experiment. Take away all these traditional sources of justice and order. What's left? Well, maybe nothing, unless there are people around who can still tap into the deepest desire of the human heart in its hunger for justice. So he's angry. He's frequently quite angry and violent. And I think he illustrates precisely, I'm going to say Christopher Nolan's a Thomist here. He illustrates precisely what both Aristotle and Aquinas teach about anger, which is that anger as wrath is one of the seven deadly sins. But Aquinas, and I gave you some quotes, argues that anger is not only not always bad, it's sometimes obligatory. That is to say, anger, if you do not feel some degree of anger in the face of serious injustice and harm, your soul is likely experiencing a kind of deficiency. He also points out why it is that Alfred at one point says to Bruce, don't get trapped inside the monster, right? He's created this image to fight fear with fear. But the danger is channeling that anger to fight against evil is that he'll be consumed by anger. So Aristotle says, really interestingly, that anger is fine as long as it is ordered to justice and as long as it is kept under the control of reason. But there's this weird thing about anger as a passion. It gets out of the control of reason very easily. And then it becomes, it twists reason in service of its own ends, right? When we get angry, it starts out sometimes justified, but if we get more and more worked up, what happens? The passion takes over, and then the passion takes over reason. And we start multiplying reasons why we should hate this person. It's it, That's brilliant about how anger is necessary, connected to justice, right? But also how anger can get out of control, which it frequently does for Bruce Wayne. A lesson on both sides of the question of anger. And also, I think, evidence of something like what Aquinas has to say about the endurance of the basic principles of the natural law. You can push lots of things aside, but one of the last things to go is going to be a real anger at serious injustice toward the innocent. And this film illustrates that. Courage, Aquinas says, is Aristotle talks about courage as primarily exercised on the field of battle. He's thinking of Homer. Courage is about attacking the enemy. But Aquinas actually argues that endurance is a greater mark of courage than attacking. I think you can see this even in battle, right? If you think about someone who goes into battle bravely, think about old warfare, hand-to-hand combat. Now think about the prisoner of war who cannot attack and who gets tortured repeatedly for days, months, years. That's courage as endurance. And Aquinas thinks that's actually a higher form of courage because it takes more to cling to the good in the face of what seems to be an insurmountable foe. And that's the kind of courage that keeps you from despair. It's the kind of courage that shows up in the martyrs. Not surprisingly, when Aquinas shifts the chief mark of courage from attack, which is the battlefield, to endurance, he has in mind the martyr rather than the soldier, or the martyr as a different kind of soldier, as the chief mark of courage. Terrence Malick's film, The Hidden Life, about Franz Jagerstatt, is precisely about this form of courage as endurance in the face of all sorts of attacks. And how are we doing here on time? Let me show one more clip. I could show more during. I've got two others on here, but I want to end with this clip from Lord of the Rings. This is the Arwen decision with respect to Aragorn in the film. This is a scene that is not in Tolkien. It's in the film, but not in the books. And from what I've read, Peter Jackson and two female assistants were thinking about the motivation of Arwen to give up her completely content life as an immortal and go marry a mortal. She has previously met with her father, who sees the future, and told her, there is nothing for you here but death. And then you get images of Aragorn dead and an older Arwen standing weeping beside him. Let me play this. So this brings up these questions about death and mortality, and also courage. She's going off to the Undying Lands with the immortals.
Take her by the safest road. A ship lies anchored in the gray havens. It waits to carry her across the sea. The last journey of Arwen Undomir.
Godwin. You cannot delay me. My lady!
I looked into your future and I saw death.
There is also life. You saw there was a child. You saw my son.
That future is almost gone.
But it is not lost.
Nothing is certain.
Great scene, really remarkable. A couple things about this. First is that, I don't know if you noticed, but when the boy runs across her path and jumps into Aragorn's arms, the boy looks at Aragorn, who looks back at the boy, and then the boy turns and looks at Arwen, who looks back at him. They never look at each other, Arwen and Aragorn, directly. They're seeing of each other is through the child. It's actually brilliant. It's also something that you can capture on film. Hitchcock said that film is not so much about dialogue or plot even. And he had really good dialogue and some pretty good plots. So what film is distinctively as an artistic medium is about showing a face, showing what the face is looking at, and then registering the change in the expression on the face because of what it's just seen. And if you, Rear Window is all about this, if you know that film. But lots of Hitchcock films are like this. This scene is perfectly like that, right? There are no words spoken. There's beautiful music, there's a beautiful setting, but it's all about Arwen looking and seeing and the boy seeing and Aragorn seeing, and then registering the change on Arwen's face as this possibility comes to the fore for her. It's really beautiful. Another thing about this is, how many, say this is a mini rom-com right here. It's not a lot of laughs, but it's kind of a rom-com, right? Where the two lovers come together and then they get torn apart. It seems they're not going to come back together. And then they do. That's the standard plot of every rom-com. How many rom-coms do you know where the decision to stay together is at least partly, if not substantially, based upon the realization, this is the person I want to have children with? Very few. Very few.
In the Bible, Leah and... God.
Well, yeah. Yeah, well, you would expect that there, but that, so you're saying the Old Testament's got a lot of rom-coms? When I watched this, I thought about that, and I thought, we've kind of edited that out of the experience of falling in love. And I think it is a natural instinct for most people that when they start to fall in love, they realize at a certain point, ooh, this is the person I want to have children with. So this film actually captures that, because that it's not, she doesn't choose to stay with Aragorn because he's the best looking human being that's ever walked Middle Earth. She doesn't choose to stay with Aragorn because he's the noblest leader. She chooses to stay with Aragorn because she knows that there's the possibility of children for them. The other part of this is that I talked about Aquinas on courage as attack versus courage as endurance, martyrdom. This is a kind of courage as endurance. She can't eliminate Aragorn's mortality. She knows that he's going to die, and she will be grieved for the rest of her days. But she's willing to endure that difficulty, courage as endurance, for the sake of the new life, for the hope of new life. So it's not just courage gritting its teeth and saying, I can hold on. It's actually courage enduring great difficulty because of a hope that exists. And because here, because of the hope of children and new life and the next generation. So that in the face of death, there's also new life. There's also birth. I think it's a beautiful scene. And it teaches us a lot about, I think, these issues of suffering, death, and courage. Let me end by reading this passage from Harry Potter. So, another thing that Aquinas says is that when we're subject to great sorrow, he has five things that assuage sorrow. One is pleasure. One is weeping. One is contemplation of truth. One is sleep and baths can help. Right? I mean, some mild sorrows at least, right? You're all, and you get a good sleep and take a bath maybe for the, he's probably thinking for the first time in a month, Aquinas is thinking. It's a little more regular for us, we hope. But the fifth one that he mentions is the love of friends. And Aquinas says two things about this. He actually describes sadness as depression, literally a weight, a physical weight that you feel in your body. So Aquinas says one of the reasons that friends assuage sorrow is that, in a sense, metaphorically, the weight of the sorrow is distributed, right? Because they share it. The second way is that the presence of friends reminds us that we are loved. And this is a counter to the sorrow. I think this passage that I'm about to read is really interesting in lots of ways. This is Christmas Eve, and Harry and Hermione visiting first the Dumbledore grave and then the Potter grave. At the Dumbledore grave, on the gravesite is, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Which is not from the Old Testament, but the New Testament, right? From the Sermon on the Mount. Then they come to the Potter grave, and they see the headstone. And beneath the birth and death dates of James and Lily Potter, Harry's parents, there's this quote, "The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death," from Corinthians. Harry read the words slowly, as though he would have only one chance to take in their meaning. And he read the last of them aloud, "The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death." A horrible thought came to him, and with it a kind of panic. Isn't that a Death Eater idea? Right there, the people, the forces they are opposing, who actually think that they can conquer and eliminate death through human magic and through doing all sorts of horrible things. Why is that there? It doesn't mean defeating death in the way the Death Eaters mean it, Harry, said Hermione, her voice gentle. It means, you know, living beyond death, living after death. I have no idea how she knows this. They do not recognize these as scriptural passages. But they were not living, thought Harry. They were gone. The empty words could not disguise the fact that his parents' moldering remains lay beneath snow and stone, indifferent and unknowing. Harry weeps. Hermione takes his hand and grips it tightly. He could not look at her, but retained the pressure, now taking deep gulps of the night air. He should have brought something to give them, but he didn't. Hermione, without him saying anything, raises her wand, moves it in a circle, and creates a wreath of Christmas roses, and Harry lays them on the grave. And they walk out arm in arm, past Dumbledore's mother and sister, back toward the dark church and the out-of-sight kissing game. It's a beautiful passage about friendship and about how to help someone grieve. If you have read this, you know that Hermione is always wanting to solve things, talks endlessly. Here, she says almost nothing. She just stands beside him. She doesn't try and wish his grief away. She gives him affection. She supplies the flowers, and she helps him start to interpret what living beyond death might mean. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.